Sister Carrie, Theodore Dreiser. In the light of the world's attitude toward women and her duties, the nature of Carrie's mental state deserves consideration. Actions, such as hers, are measured by an arbitrary scale. Society possesses a conventional standard whereby it judges all things. All men should be good, all women virtuous. Wherefore, villain, hast thou failed? For all the liberal analysis of Spencer and our modern naturalistic philosophers, we have but an infantile perception of morals. There is more in the subject than mere conformity to a law of evolution. It is yet deeper than conformity to things of earth alone. It is more involved than we, as yet, perceive. Answer first why the heart thrills. Explain wherefore some plaintive note goes wandering about the world, undying. Make clear the rose's subtle alchemy, evolving its ruddy lamp in light and rain. In the essence of these facts lie the first principles of morals. Oh, thought Drouet, how delicious is my conquest. Ah, thought Carrie, with mournful misgivings. What is it I have lost? Before this world, old proposition, we stand, serious, interested, confused, endeavoring to evolve the true theory of morals, the true answer to what is right. In the view of a certain stratum of society, Carrie was comfortably established. In the eyes of the starveling, beaten by every wind and gusty sheet of rain, she was safe in a halcyon harbor. Drouet had taken 3 rooms, furnished, in Ogden Place, facing Union Park, on the west side. That was a little, green-carpeted, breathing spot, than which, today, there is nothing more beautiful in Chicago. It afforded a vista pleasant to contemplate. The best room looked out upon the lawn of the park, now sere and brown, where a little lake lay sheltered. Over the bare limbs of the trees, which now swayed in the wintry wind, rose the steeple of the Union Park Congregational Church, and far off the towers of several others. The rooms were comfortably enough furnished. There was a good Brussels carpet on the floor, rich in dull red and lemon shades, and representing large jardiniers filled with gorgeous impossible flowers. There was a large pier-glass mirror between the 2 windows. A large, soft, green, plush-covered couch occupied 1 corner, and several rocking chairs were set about. Some pictures, several rugs, a few small pieces of bric-a-brac, and the tale of contents is told. In the bedroom, off the front room, was Carrie's trunk, bought by Drouet, and in the wardrobe, built into the wall, quite an array of clothing, more than she had ever possessed before, and of very becoming designs. There was a third room for possible use as a kitchen, where Drouet had Carrie establish a little portable gas stove for the preparation of small lunches, oysters, Welsh rarebits, and the like, of which he was exceedingly fond. And lastly, a bath. The whole place was cozy, in that it was lighted by gas and heated by furnace registers, possessing also a small grate, set with an asbestos back, a method of cheerful warming, which was then first coming into use. By her industry and natural love of order, which now developed, the place maintained an air pleasing in the extreme. Here, then, was Carrie, established in a pleasant fashion, free of certain difficulties which most ominously confronted her, laden with many new ones which were of a mental order, and altogether so turned about in all of her earthly relationships that she might well have been a new and different individual. She looked into her glass and saw a prettier Carrie than she had seen before. She looked into her mind, a mirror prepared of her own and the world's opinions, and saw a worse. Between these 2 images, she wavered, hesitating which to believe. "My, but you're a little beauty," Jue was wont to exclaim to her. She would look at him with large, pleased eyes. "You know it, don't you?" he would continue. "Oh, I don't know," she would reply, feeling delight in the fact that one should think so, hesitating to believe, though she really did, that she was vain enough to think so much of herself. Her conscience, however, was not a Jue interested to praise. There she heard a different voice, with which she argued, pleaded, excused. It was no just and sapient counselor in its last analysis. It was only an average little conscience, a thing which represented the world, her past environment, habit, convention, in a confused way. With it, the voice of the people was truly the voice of God.
"Oh, thou failure," said the voice.
"Why?" she questioned.
"Look at those about," came the whispered answer. "Look at those who are good. How would they scorn to do what you have done? Look at the good girls. How will they draw away from such as you, when they know you have been weak? You had not tried before you failed."
It was when Carrie was alone, looking out across the park, that she would be listening to this. It would come infrequently when something else did not interfere. When the pleasant side was not too apparent, when Jue was not there. It was somewhat clear in utterance at first, but never wholly convincing. There was always an answer, always the December days threatened. She was alone. She was desireful. She was fearful of the whistling wind. The voice of want made answer for her. Once the bright days of summer pass by, a city takes on that somber garb of gray, wrapped in which it goes about its labors during the long winter. Its endless buildings look gray. Its sky and its streets assume a somber hue. The scattered, leafless trees and wind-blown dust and paper but add to the general solemnity of color. There seems to be something in the chill breezes which scurry through the long, narrow thoroughfares, productive of rueful thoughts. Not poets alone, nor artists, nor that superior order of mind, which arrogates to itself all refinement, feel this, but dogs and all men. These feel as much as the poet, though they have not the same power of expression. The sparrow upon the wire, the cat in the doorway, the dray horse tugging his weary load, feel the long, keen breaths of winter. It strikes to the heart of all life, animate and inanimate. If it were not for the artificial fires of merriment, the rush of profit-seeking trade, and pleasure-selling amusements, if the various merchants failed to make the customary display within and without their establishments, if our streets were not strung with signs of gorgeous hues and thronged with hurrying purchasers, we would quickly discover how firmly the chill hand of winter lays upon the heart, how dispiriting are the days during which the sun withholds a portion of our allowance of light and warmth. We are more dependent upon these things than is often thought. We are insects produced by heat and pass without it. In the drag of such a gray day, the secret voice would assert itself, feebly and more feebly. Such mental conflict was not always uppermost. Carrie was not by any means a gloomy soul. More, she had not the mind to get firm hold upon a definite truth. When she could not find her way out of the labyrinth of ill logic, which thought upon the subject created, she would turn away entirely.